March 29th, you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
I'm afraid of your prey, and I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. Rise up to your higher power, free up from fear, it will devour you. Watch out for the ego of the hour, the ones who say they know it are the ones who will impose it on you.
We have a new theme song that you just heard. That was I Ain't Afraid by singer, songwriter, and activist Holly Near. Isn't that a cool song? Very, very humanist message to that song. We are grateful here at the Institute to Holly Near for allowing the Institute for Humanist Studies to use her music. As you know, you normally have to pay to use a theme song in a radio or TV show. Holly generously waived the normal licensing fees so that the Institute for Humanist Studies can use her song in our show for free. Holly Near has been performing for nearly her entire life. She's also a lifelong activist for peace, social justice, and human rights. About 20 years ago, Holly Near was one of the first out lesbian singers and did much to help the world realize that all humans should be treated equal regardless of sexual orientation. And yet, throughout her activist career, she's been very careful not to separate lesbian and gay issues out from the full gamut of human rights issues. She's often called for gay and lesbian issues to be part of the larger world peace agenda, and she's also encouraged the gay and lesbian community itself to have a world consciousness and to end racism and sexism within their own community and within the community at large. If you want to learn more about Holly Near, very cool singer, very cool activist, you can visit HollyNear.com. That's HollyNear.com. Thanks again, Holly. Okay, the first half of our show has somewhat of a theme. We're going to hear from three young free thinkers, two young women and one young man, all highly intelligent and motivated. Allison Bates will speak about the activities of the Secular Student Alliance, which is an international student free thought group. Next, we hear from two interns of the Institute for Humanist Studies, Judd Crasher, a high school senior, and Sarah Habib, who's a college senior. We'll hear some listener comments about another young free thinker, Hemant Mehta, the eBay atheist. And then, just when you're in the mood for some British accents, we'll hear from Casper Melville, editor of the New Humanist magazine, and Matt Cherry, Executive Director of the Institute for Humanist Studies. Matt's going to be speaking to Casper about faith and politics in the United Kingdom. Before we get started, however, there are probably a few of you out there, at least, who are asking, what the heck is this show about? And you're also asking, what is humanism? What are they talking about? Here's some text taken directly from the brand new website of the Institute for Humanist Studies, which makes programs like Humanist Network News possible. If you haven't seen it yet, I promise you will be impressed by our new website, humaniststudies.org. Here's what the Institute says about humanism. Humanism is a philosophy of life inspired by humanity and guided by reason. It provides the basis for a fulfilling and ethical life without religion. Humanists make sense of the world using reason, experience, and shared human values. Humanists see no convincing evidence for gods, the supernatural, or life after death. Humanists believe that moral values are properly founded on human empathy and scientific understanding. Humanists believe we must live this life on the basis that it is the only life we'll have. That, therefore, we must make the most of it for ourselves, each other, and our world. Humanist philosophies have arisen separately in many different cultures over many thousands of years. Whether or not they use the term humanism, tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of millions of people around the world agree with a humanist philosophy of living a happy and productive life based on reason and compassion. Are you a humanist? Maybe. Well, maybe you should check out humaniststudies.org. The Institute for Humanist Studies also offers online courses in humanism at humanisteducation.com. All right, let's get to the show. A few weeks ago, I had the chance to speak with Allison Bates, the campus organizer for the Secular Student Alliance. The Secular Student Alliance, or SSA, is an international educational nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting scientific reason, critical inquiry, and secularism among college and high school students. Allison visited the Humanist Center in Albany, New York, where HNN is produced, earlier this month. The Albany area has quite a few colleges and universities, so Allison was here visiting to stir up interest in the student secular movement. As the recently hired Secular Student Alliance campus organizer, Bates works to provide support to more than 50 SSA student groups in more than 8 countries. Bates, who is 25, earned a bachelor's degree from Ohio Wesleyan University in 2004. She majored in philosophy and minored in both political science and humanities classics. Allison, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Duncan.
Allison, can you tell us, what is the Secular Student Alliance? What do you guys do?
We're an educational nonprofit, and we are trying to help students get involved in the free thought movement by organizing campus groups.
Mm-hmm. And you're the campus organizer. That's your position. So tell us, what does a campus organizer do? What's your job?
Essentially, my job is to kind of spread the word that we exist and help students establish and then let them know about all the SSA services, Secular mm-hmm. Student Alliance services, mm-hmm. and how we can help them maintain their group.
So you're visiting here at the Humanist Center, home of the Institute for Humanist Studies right now, and you're visiting some of the local colleges. What are some of the schools you've been to so far?
Well, the schools that I've hit in the last 3 days have included Williams College, which is in Massachusetts, where I actually met some students who were interested in what I was doing. I was hanging up flyers to tell mm-hmm. them about SSA.
So they saw you hanging up a flyer and they just came over and said,
yeah, and they came over and then we got to talking and we actually had lunch together. And other than that, I've been to SUNY Albany and Empire and a bunch of the other schools in the area.
Union College, my alma mater.
Union
Let's not
College.
Forget. okay, so right now you're kind of, what do they call it, like canvassing or flyering? What do you call it, flyering the
we
campuses?
We call it flyering.
Okay, so you're flyering campuses. So suppose you did talk to some students. So suppose someone finds your flyer at RPI and they're interested in starting a free thought group on campus. What happens next? What do they do?
So on these flyers is the information to our website, secularstudents.org, and they go online and then you request a group starting packet. And in this packet, I send out all the information about common pitfalls and how to avoid those when starting and running a group, and lots of information about the free thought movement in general. Mm-hmm. And then I keep in touch with these students, ask them, have you started a group? How's that going? Do you need any suggestions? Do you need any meeting ideas? Can I help you get some money? And then we just keep in touch as they start to get their group on the ground.
So how many groups do you have right now? How many student chapters are there? Are you an international group, by the way?
We are an international group.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how many chapters do you have and where are they located?
We have 54 groups right now.
Okay.
We have a group in Bangladesh. We have a group in the UK. We have groups all in almost every state in the country.
Mm-hmm. And are most of the groups in the U.S. and Canada, or how's it kind of broken up?
Most of them are in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Actually, the state with the most groups is actually Texas, which is interesting.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is the group we had a column by a student group in the H&N e-zine. They were in Texas, and they were doing a smut for smut campaign where they were exchanging. If you brought in your religious scripture, they would give you some free porn in exchange. Are they one of the member groups of the SSA? Or are they? You don't know if they're.
I'm not positive now.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they are either. We'll have to check that out. So, okay. Well, first, where can people find more information about the Secular Student Alliance? What's your website? What's the URL?
We have a brand new website, actually, mm-hmm. and it's secularstudents.org.
Okay. And what's on there? You guys have an e-news, kind of an e-zine, right?
We have an e-news. We also have the SSA services. So if groups are affiliate members, which mm-hmm. is a really easy process to actually officially affiliate, mm-hmm. then we offer you all these services. We give grants, We have a speakers bureau, so if you'd like to request a speaker, I'll help you set that up and organize all the logistics, and mm-hmm. we can have somebody come to your campus and give a lecture.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about, you mentioned grants. I think I heard about you have some mini grants for students to apply if they want to travel to a conference. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We offer travel grants to students who are interested in attending our conferences. We also have project grants if your group wants to do anything your group wants to do. If you want something as small as t-shirts, or if you need money to organize a really cool event, mm-hmm. you can apply for a grant, and we usually give students some money.
Now, if anyone's listening who would like to offer his or her services as a speaker, I mean, how does that work? Can they contact the Secular Student Alliance to say, hey, I'd like to be considered as a speaker to some of these college groups? Is that...
Absolutely.
Okay. And what about, I feel like a lot of professors might spot these flyers, and a lot of professors might be interested in starting a group too. Can a professor start a student group, a secular student group?
Yeah, actually there's a group right now forming at Eastern Washington University, and that was all initiated because a professor was the one who requested the information and just spread it along to some students that he thought would be interested, and now there's a group.
Mm-hmm. Now, I vaguely remember... 2 years ago, I did a Darwin Day press release, and I quoted August Brunsman, your executive director, and I think the Secular Student Alliance was distributing Darwin Day packets. What do you guys, do you do something for Darwin Day?
We do. It's up to the individual groups if they want to participate in Darwin Day, but mm-hmm. last year, we had 30 out of the 54 request information and hold Darwin Day events.
And I remember some of the ideas where you could dress up like an ape. And walk around campus, you could have a primordial soup banquet.
Anything goes. Yeah, whatever the groups want to do to celebrate.
I remember that press release I sent out, I sent it out to thousands of newsrooms, and it got picked up at a lot of places. I remember there was one publisher in Georgia who really gave me a hard time for the ape costume idea. The headline was Kooky Evolutionists. We just did an article in the H&N e-zine about all the upcoming conferences. A lot of free thought groups, national groups, have their conference like in spring, and I saw your name appear on a couple of them. Are you going to be speaking at a few conferences in the future?
I am. The first one is going to be in Boston for the SHJ, which is the Society for Humanistic Judaism, and I'm doing this project on getting young women, especially college women, involved in free thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is going to be kind of a research project and a strategic planning thing to get more women involved at the college level.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did that come about? I mean, I met you at the Free Thought Summit, Heads Summit in Los Angeles, and there was also a Secular Coalition for America meeting like a day before the Heads Summit. And the SSA is a member of the SCA, mm-hmm. Secular Coalition. And during that meeting, I believe the Society for Humanistic Judaism officially became a member, right? So is that how this came about, or had you been working with them before then? Or?
Well, it all came about because I'm going to be in Boston doing exactly what I'm here in Albany doing, mm-hmm. hanging up flyers at these various campuses. And there's also a conference for SHJ conveniently the same weekend that I'm
right.
going to be there.
Right.
So I asked if I could give a presentation, and they agreed.
So that actually really helps if some of the national or even some of the local free thought groups, if they hear this podcast, they're like, oh, we want to get, you know, Allison Bates to come to, you know, to speak to our group. You know, it's nice if you can kind of piggyback events, right? So you
Absolutely.
Can do some of your flyering and you can speak to a group maybe. And especially if those groups wanted to, let's say, assist with your travel expenses, that would really be a benefit to the Secular Student Alliance, right?
Of course, and they could do that if they go on the first page of the website, Secular mm-hmm. Students, and there's a donate link.
Yeah, you guys are a 501c3 nonprofit, right?
So correct.
Everything is tax deductible. All right, well, I've been reading, I was reading the Wall Street Journal today, and I noticed that the chair of your board of directors was on the front page, and it seems like he's becoming quite a celebrity. So have you met Hemant Mehta? We had him on the show last month. Have you met him?
I have had the pleasure of meeting Hemant, yes.
Uh-huh. And what do you think? Is this guy, you know, is he a solid guy or is he a little bit...
No, he's a great guy, of course. I mean, he's done this stunt that has taken on a life of its own.
Uh-huh. I'm definitely impressed. I'm glad to say I knew him back when he was doing podcasts for H&N. Well, Allison, where are you guys based?
We're based in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, and do you have an office, or what's...
We're looking into getting our first office right now.
Okay.
As it stands, we don't have an official office, and we, both me and the executive director, work from home. But we're shopping around for an office right now.
You work from home. Yes. I had no idea that you work from home. Mm-hmm. Your work is always so professional. I had no idea.
Well, thank you.
I hope the folks listening are hearing this. We have this great group with 54 chapters throughout the world, and they don't have an office, people. So, I hope everyone considers giving a donation to the Secular Student Alliance. Once again, your website is secularstudents.org. People can visit that site and read your e-news and subscribe to that. The Institute for Humanist Studies is a major financial supporter of the SSA, so we're putting our money where our mouth is, too. And I hope you will. Allison, do you have anything else that we forgot to mention?
No, thank you so much, Duncan.
Yeah, well, thanks for being here. I hope I'll see you again on your next tour of upstate New York. Mm-hmm. The weather was okay for you this time, I guess. Could have been worse.
It was fine, yeah.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Humanist Network News, an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. We were listening to Allison Bates, campus organizer of the Secular Student Alliance. To learn more about the Secular Student Alliance, visit www.secularstudents.org. The Institute for Humanist Studies, through its IHS grant fund, is a major financial supporter of the Secular Student Alliance. You can learn more about the Institute and the IHS grant fund by visiting the Institute's brand new, beautiful website at www.humaniststudies.org. Next, we're going to hear from Judd Crasher, who just finished an internship with our public policy director, Tim Gordonier. Judd is a senior at Bern Knox Westerlo High School, where he's enrolled in a program called New Visions Law and Government. That's a program based in Albany, New York, for gifted high school seniors who come from around the entire Capital District, and they participate in an advanced study of law and the workings of the U.S. government. As part of his studies, Judd was here at the Institute to gain a better understanding of our Constitution and also to see how lobbying works. Dr. Gordonier, our public policy director, is also a registered lobbyist in New York State. He lobbies the New York State legislature on issues of concern to humanists. Here's something that Judd provided for me earlier when he started his internship for our e-zine, humanistnetworknews.org. An agnostic, Judd says he is excited to learn about the Institute for Humanist Studies and is ready to work hard on advancing humanist goals. Well, let's listen to him and see at the end of his program if he feels like he if he accomplished those goals. Here's Judd. Hey, Judd. Thanks for being here today.
You're welcome.
I'd like to know, this is your you have one more day left with your internship as a public policy intern at the Institute, and I'm just wondering, can you tell me a little about what you've been doing?
I've been doing extensive research with the public policy director here, Tim, and I've researched various issues. Just recently, I finished researching the issue of right to die and have helped him write some articles for the Institute's website.
Uh-huh. Now, Judd, you are you're a senior in high school?
I'm a high school senior.
And in the Albany area. And do you cover some of these issues in your regular courses in high school?
No, I don't. It's this has been a very original experience here at the Institute. I have researched topics that I've researched on my own time, but as far as school is concerned, it's pretty neutral, and you don't really talk about these issues.
Right. So what brought you? What interested you in interning here? How'd you learn about the Institute?
Well, currently I'm enrolled in a program called New Visions Law and Government, and it's a program for high school seniors, honors program, completely college level. Uh-huh. And in the course of the program, you go through three internships. A few months ago, I was at the Attorney General's Environmental Protection Bureau.
Right.
Now I'm here at the Institute, and actually a friend of my mother turned me on to the Institute of Humanist Studies. I really didn't know about humanism at all until I was told about this, and I did a little research into what humanism is, and I became immediately attracted, and now I'm here.
Great.
So do you have
what are your future plans? Do you want to be a lawyer or a policy analyst, political scientist?
I am so confused right now about what I want to do right now. I'm thinking about being a lawyer. I'm also thinking about going into teaching, but I'm certainly not taking any options off the table. Who knows where college will take me.
Right. I should say for our listeners, too, who can't actually see you, Judd, you are the best-dressed person in the building right now.
Thank
you're a very
much.
Astute young man.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm sure you're going to do fine.
Thank you.
Whatever you choose to do. So, all right, I've got something. You were helping me compile some statistics from surveys over the past few years that I have in massive piles in my office that are going to fall down on me one day and suffocate me. But I have a new one that you haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's by the Barna Group. It's their annual survey on Americans' top priority. And this year, for the first time, faith placed number two. For Americans' top priority, and that's behind family. However, they do have an interesting statistic about young people. It says that people under the age of 40 are half as likely to put faith as their top priority. I was just wondering, if I could quiz you right now, just randomly sampling a young American. Judd, what is your top priority? And I'll give you a couple options. You can answer however you want. But some of the options on this survey were family, health, lifestyle, leisure, money, achieving success. What do you think is your top priority?
Right now, I believe my top priority is getting into a college, and a college where I want to attend.
Right.
So I guess that would fall under achieving success.
Right.
At the same time, I could understand why people would have family and have faith as their top priorities, but certainly with me right now, and I think with young people in general, it's understandable that their priorities are elsewhere right now. It's a very stressful and even confusing time to be deciding where you want to head off in the future. So,
Let me ask you something, Judd. Tell me a little bit about some of young people today. Not that I consider myself old, but. Do issues of religion and spirituality and faith come up? I mean, I remember being in high school. My friends went to most of my friends went to Catholic school.
Right.
We never talked about religion.
Right.
Are you guys talking about this?
It's very interesting. I have a group of friends who are very diverse in their beliefs, and I go to a school in a very very I'm in the sticks, to be quite honest.
Right.
And it's interesting because I have a friend who attended a Catholic school, and she is one of the most free-thinking, dare I say agnostic, people I know. So it's interesting because we have debates all the time about religion, and especially the role religion plays in government, and we've gotten in heated debates, which is really nice because I've talked to people who are far older than me, and that didn't happen. It was a lot more uniform in what people felt.
Right.
So it's great for me to sit down and talk to people my age about issues that in the past were something that only the grown-ups would talk about.
Right. Do you think, though, that young people are able to accept their differences and just agree to disagree or talk about it? Because I know that there's a young man right now, Hemant Mehta, who's gaining international celebrity for his dialogue between atheists and Christians. It has to do with auctioning himself off. And one of the reasons why he did this was he wanted to hear what the other side had to say and see what they had to offer before he became hardened and basically a curmudgeon. And I'm just wondering, are young people, are they already curmudgeons? Are they already set in their ways? Or are they willing to talk about these
things? I don't think they're set in their ways at all, at least from my own experience. I think we are very willing to accept different viewpoints, and especially in the time we live in now. There are so many conflicts between ideology, and not just religious ideology, but political ideology.
Right.
And I think we see that young people, and we don't want to follow in these footsteps.
Right.
And we have seen, seen in the news that this conflict, religious conflict specifically, can lead to death and can lead to a lot of sorrow for people. So I think we read and listen to what goes on in the news, and we are I think, very careful observers of what goes on, mm-hmm. and we are very careful to claim that we're positively right.
Yeah.
And I think we're pretty good at being accepting other people's beliefs.
Yeah. Well, Jed, I'm feeling better about the future of America after
yes.
talking with you. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, but also thanks for all your work at the Institute.
You're welcome.
You will be missed. I hope you drop by and visit us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
What do you think? Judd for president? Well, I'm going to watch that guy. He's definitely going places. That was Judd Crasher, a high school senior who just finished an internship with the Institute for Humanist Studies last week. On Monday, I spoke with another intern at the Institute, Sarah Habib. Sarah is now completing her second internship with us. She just can't seem to get enough of this place. Sarah is a senior at the University at Albany. She is interning with Judy Disco, the Institute's Director of Administration, and who is also our Women's Studies Liaison. Here's Sarah. So, Sarah, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Can you, you've been interning with the Institute for two semesters now, and could you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing while you're here?
The first semester, it was an independent study through the Women's Studies Department, and it was research on female genital mutilation.
Mm-hmm.
And the second semester is a half class and a half internship combined, and I'm researching how religion discriminates against women, looking at Islam, Judaism, and Catholicism.
It looks like both semesters you had a common theme. I mean, female genital mutilation would also be an example of how, women are the victims of religious practices, right?
Mm-hmm. It's religious and cultural. It's a mix of both.
Well, what did you find? Let's start with the female genital mutilation. What were you looking at specifically? Were you looking at this occurrence in America or what in specific?
I was looking at immigration cases of people that were coming here and applying for citizenship.
Mm-hmm. They're looking for asylum. They were going to have this procedure was going to be forced upon them in their home country, right?
Yeah, it was women and children who wanted asylum from their husbands or their dead husbands' families that were wanting them to get it done even though the husband wasn't around anymore.
Right. And is this a common occurrence or how often does this happen?
It still happens pretty frequently.
In America, we have a lot of people trying to basically...
No, in other countries, they're trying to come in here to get away from the female genital mutilation.
Right, and so we have a lot of people in that situation. They're trying to flee to America?
Yes, or other countries, just as long as they're out of Africa where it's dominantly done.
Mm-hmm. And what is the world doing, about this? Is the UN looking to go into Africa and stop this procedure? Or?
The UN made a couple of comments, but they didn't take affirmative action and actually do something about it.
You know, I'm actually curious as to your perspective on this. It's always tricky if it's a cultural practice. You know, do you believe that someone like a group like the UN, maybe the UN should go in and ban this practice?
No, because anything that gets banned just gets done more.
Right. Right.
So
you would take more of the... Do you believe
that... They need to be educated. The problem is it's not that they're doing this. It's
right.
the fact that they're doing it in unsanitary conditions.
Right.
Like, they will do this with a piece of glass, and it's a big ritual, and the woman or the young lady could bleed to death, and
right.
it's nothing to them. If they want to do it, it should be done like when a man gets circumcised in a hospital or in sanitary conditions.
But female genital mutilation, isn't it basically just to remove the pleasure from... sex? I mean, isn't that the objective?
That's part of it. The other part is so that the woman doesn't stray. So it removes the pleasure so she doesn't stray away from her man.
Really?
A man can be married to like five women and, you know, he gets all this pleasure and a woman's not allowed to stray. She's only supposed to be with this one man.
Right.
And by cutting off her pleasure system, it prevents
yeah.
her from desiring another man.
So I kind of think, like, if you're going to be educating people about the sanitary procedure, you should also maybe educate women about what this is really about. Do these women know what they're signing on for, or do they just have no choice?
The problem is that they're not educated. They don't know any better. If they knew about the pleasure and that, you know, that they
right.
have rights to it, then
right.
it's a different story.
Right.
But in order to work with the problem before, you'd have to, you know, be like, women, you should fight for this. They should first work a sanitary conditions out so women aren't dying and, you know, suffering.
So how do you feel about that, though? Do you think that it's okay for the Western world to, well, let's
impose
say one...
their views?
Exactly. What do you think about that?
Well, that's why I'm saying it's better that they get educated, because then they're going to fight off. They're going to be resistant towards
right,
it.
Right. Okay, good. So what do you? So tell me a little bit more about what you're working on. This semester, yeah.
This semester I'm working on how religion discriminates against women, mm-hmm. and I'm also doing court cases again, because I'm a double major, women's studies and political science, so I like the court case aspects of things.
Mm-hmm.
I found a woman who's from Queens, and she worked as a teacher at a Catholic high school or elementary school, I'm not sure,
mm-hmm.
and she got fired for being pregnant and unmarried.
Right.
So it's kind of discrimination, because if a man was unmarried and he got a woman pregnant and he was a teacher,
right,
nothing would happen to him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and have you looked at any other cases like that, or is that the main one you focused on so far?
That's the main one I focused on because it recently happened.
Yeah, I remember when it happened. I think Tim had written something about it when it happened. Okay, and so I want to skip around a little bit. Sarah, you mentioned to me you were born in Egypt, right?
Yes.
And you lived there for 7 years?
Yes.
Do you remember anything about, Egypt in those first 7 years? You were kind of young, but...
Yeah, but what I remember is, little kid stuff. Like, I remember my house, I remember my family members, but other than that, shopping is different. They don't have, stores like they do here. Everything's out on the street.
Right.
It's like Manhattan, all the vendors, and you sit there and negotiate prices, and that's how it's done.
And have you been back since?
I chose not to go back until I get my American passport, because I'm afraid if I go back with an Egyptian passport, I'm going to have problems getting out of Egypt to come back here because I'm a woman.
As a woman? Really?
Yes.
Did your experience growing up in Egypt, or is being an Egyptian, of Egyptian heritage, did that in any way influence your interest in this topic of women's studies and politics?
Yeah, because my parents had an arranged marriage, and so I don't support that, and I don't understand why they still follow this cultural belief from such a long time ago, they never got modernized.
Right.
So that's my focus, is why I became a women's studies major.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. This is fascinating stuff. You've been doing great work, and we're all glad that you've been here. Thanks for what you've done.
You're welcome.
And what do you plan on doing? What's next for you? What do you plan on doing?
Graduating college. I'm supposed to graduate this semester.
Yeah? And then do you have any aspirations or ambitions for what you want to do after?
I don't know. I'm going to apply to law school, see where that goes.
All right.
And apply to grad school.
All right, well, we'll be watching for you. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
This is Rabbi Binyamin Biber of the Society for Humanistic Judaism, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. We were just listening to Sarah Habib, Women's Studies Intern of the Institute for Humanist Studies. I don't know. Now that I've heard Sarah, I think Judd might have some competition for his run for president. What do you think? Well, now it's time to hear some listener comments, not about that topic, but about another rising star in the free thought movement, Hemant Mehta. I spoke to Hemant in the last HNN podcast. In case you missed it, Hemant is the 22-year-old atheist from Chicago who put out an unusual item on the eBay auction block. He allowed the highest bidder to send him to church, to the church of his or her choosing. A group called Off the Map won Hemant's auction, and instead of sending him to one church, they're sending him to all sorts of churches in the Chicago area. As an atheist, Hemant critiques the churches and blogs about his visits on the Off the Map website at otmatheist.com and on his own blog at ebayatheist.blogspot.com. Hemant is also the chair of the Secular Student Alliance Board of Directors. Since the last HNN podcast, Hemant's story made the front page of the Wall Street Journal on Thursday, March 9th, 2006. The story wasn't exactly above the fold, but the first part of the headline, which read "Young Atheist Gives," did actually appear above the fold on A1 of the Wall Street Journal. Am I the only one who obsesses over these things? I don't know. I also do public relations and media relations for the Institute in addition to this podcast, so maybe I am a little bit obsessed about those things. Anyway, as you can imagine, the Wall Street Journal article caused a media frenzy. It was kind of like what happened when Lori Lipman Brown lobbyist for the Secular Coalition for America made it into USA Today. And, of course, yours truly was also quoted, had a minor quote in that article as well. Hemant's been all over the network, television, radio, and in print media since the story broke. His story even made it into the newspapers in India and also in France so far. So he's now an international celebrity of sorts. In our weekly HNN e-zine, humanistnetworknews.org, we asked readers to call the HNN listener line to share their thoughts on Hemant's auction and on the developing story. Here are two listeners with two very different takes on the whole thing.
Hi, my name is Mark, and I'm in Round Rock, Texas. I'm posting on the Hemant's website as Texas Atheist, just TX Atheist. And I think it's going very well. At first, I thought Hemant was doing it as a attention grabber, but I think he really is trying to bond the two. And my synopsis of the whole thing is most Americans are completely unaware of what atheism actually is. And it's been eye-opening for both sides, but I think when people become familiar with atheism, they're not so much against it. They might not understand it or agree with it, but they are less inclined to believe it's anti-God or anti-religion or devil worship, which to me is progress. So my hat's off to Hemant. Very much. Thank you. And I appreciate Jim sponsoring for this move.
Hi, my name is Leslie A. Zucker, and I'm a leader of the Reed College Free Thinkers based in Portland, Oregon, the United States of America. And I wanted to comment on Hemant Mehta's eBay auction where he wanted to quote-unquote sell his soul, as it has been referred sort of colloquially. First of all, I want to say that I do respect and admire Hemant's work with the Secular Student Alliance, and some of my concerns about the eBay auction, you know, are all notwithstanding the good work he's done and are not meant in any way to divide the free thought movement in any way, shape, or form. However, that being said, I'm very concerned about the fact that a quote-unquote free thinker would need to accept any kind of money in order to go to church, even if that money was being donated, as it was, to the Secular Student Alliance. I really think that that sends a bad message to the community at large, because it basically says that we've already made up our minds that we're atheists, that we wouldn't go to church anyway and be constantly reevaluating our beliefs. I consider myself a weak atheist. I talk with religious friends all the time about the existence of a creator. I've attended several church services, including, more religious services and humanistic Jewish services and, you know, just across the map of, you know, different faiths, and, you know, have attended the Unitarian Universalist Club and the Christian Club. And I really believe that and not putting an auction online that gets national attention is a true expression of free thinking. And this in general underscores a concern that I have, that too often that the free thinking movement is looking to get quick publicity to spread its message, instead of quietly going about our business and living out our humanistic values of doing good for humanity and of thinking free from coercion. Because I really believe that true free thinking means thinking freely, and that means, you know, free of external reward, either for oneself personally, for Hemant, or for the Secular Student Alliance. And I would hope that it's free thinkers first, and definitely, as atheists or whatever our non-theistic creed is, second, that we would unite around the banner of thinking, because we believe that reason is really the best criterion for truth alone, and not any kind of external reward, not any kind of publicity, or not any kind of headline in the Seattle Times or the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for your time. And again, this is Leslie Zucker, a leader of the Reed College Freethinkers.
Thanks, Mark and Leslie. We really appreciate hearing what you have to say. And hey, all you listeners out there, speak up. Call the HNN listener comment line at 206 339-4168. When you call the H&N listener line, you reach a recording. That's my voice. It's like reaching an answer machine. You can leave a comment about anything you hear in this show or read in the H&N e-zine, humanistnetworknews.org. Hey, you can even leave a comment about anything related to humanism at all. Just let us know what's going on in your neck of the woods. Let us know what you think and feel. Don't be shy. Once again, that number is 206-339-4168. Hemant will be on the Infidel Guy show tonight at 8 p.m. You can listen to that through a live stream at www.infidelguy.com, or you can hear it later on the Infidel Guy podcast. To read more media placements about Hemant, including that Wall Street Journal article, visit ebayatheist.blogspot.com. You definitely have to check out the little hand-drawn illustration of Hemant's head in the Wall Street Journal article. You know how the Wall Street Journal does those little hand-drawn headshots? Well, you know you've arrived when you have a hand-drawn headshot of yourself. So check out the hand-drawn Hemant headshot, little Hemant head. You're listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. So what do you think? Is the sound quality starting to improve in our show? I know there's still a little bit of a bite when I talk, but I think it's getting better. Over the last month, I've been obsessing over these things. No, I've been trying to do a few things to cut down on the sound reflections in our recording room to try to take out some of that echo. I've now got some acoustical foam thumbtack to the wall. Looks like upholstered leather on a chair or a couch. I've got a couple curtains one of them my mom helped me sew, but actually sewed for me. But the other one I actually made myself. And, I've got a few more things I'm going to keep doing, maybe a few more curtains to help. Why am I bringing all this up? Well, one of the first reviews on iTunes of the H&N podcast was very critical of our sound quality. But did you even know that you can review the H&N podcast on iTunes? There are three reviews on there right now on the U.S. version, and at least one on iTunes Canada. If you want to review H&N in iTunes, I put a link to review the show in our show notes at ihs.libsyn.com. Or if you're in iTunes right now listening, you can click on the music store and then do a search for Humanist Network News. Our iTunes page should pop up, and just look for the write a review link. Here's an early review that came out after our second show. This is the one about the sound quality. It's the headline, the title is Great Promise, Poor Quality. And this person, Olo Jan, gave us 2 stars. The problem with podcasting means that everyone with a microphone and a computer thinks they should be podcasting. Constructive criticism, poor sound quality, goofy special effects, choppy interview. But it is an important subject matter, even if it isn't a well-organized treatment. I give them kudos for even daring to question big religion. I'd say stick with this podcast to see if they improve over time. I'm rooting for them. Yeah, and the problem with iTunes reviews is that anyone with a keyboard and internet connection thinks he or she should be reviewing podcasts. No, I'm just kidding. Don't ever, ever upset the critics. I'm just kidding, Olo Jan. I thank you for your brutally honest critique. Ouch. But listen, those weren't goofy sound effects, all right? Those were real sounds that Marty was making when he was trying to solder together our phone recorder. Honest. Okay. No more cartoon crashes unless another reviewer requests them. But here's another one from Lucid Carbon. This person gave us 5 stars. This is a cool review. It says, it's like a good bizarro world. After years of listening to crazy right-wing talk radio, it's almost surreal to hear the same format filled with such reasonable and well-articulated opinions and observations. I am going to keep listening for sure. And here's a review from iTunes Canada, which will not show up in your iTunes if you're in the U.S. The H&N podcast is excellent. It begins with a simple description of what humanism is and why many people are interested in it, followed by interviews and conversations on an array of important topics with some playful bits of music and news. The content is very interesting for political, social, and individual reasons, not too heavy nor too light. a worthwhile and enjoyable listen. Thanks to all of you out there who took the time to review our show, and I hope to see more reviews of H&N soon. Whew. We've been doing a lot of talking, so and as our Canadian reviewer said, not too light, not too heavy. I think we got to lighten it up a little bit and take a musical interlude. This is Philip Flathead with The Ballad of Timothy Leary.
Well, the truth comes out and the ship begins to fly. The man seems so sincere, even his lips moved. Now the money's gone and the bonds begin to fly. Her body's scattered everywhere, no one's asking why. Hey, hey, now, Timothy Leary said to me, tune and turn on him, question authority. Don't listen to them without resistance. Said you are the captain of your own existence. Feeling free, well, look all around you. That's the sound of the man, he's coming down on you. Yeah, you better run, take some cover. He's coming down on us, my sisters and brothers, with a club like ours. You and me, we should get together and let everybody be free. With a club like ours, you know, we won't need no president.
Listening to Humanist Network News, an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. That was The Ballad of Timothy Leary by Philip Flathead off the album Four Track Mind. The song was made available through a Creative Commons license. Thanks to PodSafeAudio.com for making it easy to locate songs like that. You can hear more of Philip Flathead's music at philipflathead.com. There are two L's in Philip. You know, I heard Timothy Leary speak once here in Albany. I think it was a junior in high school, and I went to one of the local colleges here to see him. It was about 2 weeks before he died, actually, and it was pretty sad. He's a smart guy, but he had completely fried his brain on drugs and LSD in particular. And the point of his talk show the point of his talk was how he was trying to explain how virtual reality would be the new safer LSD. And I remember thinking a couple things. I remember thinking the new LSD, that's not an original idea. I think it was Dennis Miller who had been calling Nintendo Kitty Cocaine for years before that. Kitty Cocaine, Nintendo. But seriously, the talk was a total disaster. I mean, Leary had this multimedia presentation, and it kept crashing on him, which is annoying. This was even before the age of PowerPoints, but it's the same basic thing. He kept losing his train of thought. I'm one to talk, but still. And the college kids in the audience, it was pathetic. They just kept throwing bags of pot at him on stage, and they were yelling, "Smell this, Leary!" Which, of course, he did. And I think it was 2 weeks later he died, and I think he had his head, like, frozen and shot up into space or something. Oh, man, I've probably got some Tim Leary fans all riled up, and you're going to send me some angry messages. But, hey, why don't you call the H&N listener comment line to yell at me, 206-339-4168. Anyway, for our last segment, Matt Sherry, Executive Director of the Institute for Humanist Studies, will be speaking with Casper Melville, who is the editor of New Humanist magazine. New Humanist is an excellent, glossy magazine published in London. It covers all sorts of issues, but with a humanist perspective. A little more mainstream than the humanist publications you find over here in the U.S. Every other month, we try to check in with Casper to see what's going on in Europe. Here's Casper.
Hello, Casper.
Hello, Matt.
I've been reading a lot in the last few weeks about some comments that Prime Minister Tony Blair made about God and religion and the war in Iraq. Could you tell our listeners a little bit of background about that?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was Tony Blair appeared on what we call here Parkinson, because this is a chat show on a Saturday night. With probably the longest running chat show, Michael Parkinson is the host. He's a kind of avuncular, craggy northern man, sort of quite, you know, well, very well known in the country.
He's the sort of Johnny Carson of UK TV,
exactly,
I think.
Exactly. I suppose that he's, I mean, not quite. It's not quite so jokey even as the Johnny Carson show. It's quite straight, but a little bit, you know, celebrity, pretty much celebrity culture, although sometimes intellectual celebrity. So Tony Blair goes on there, which is in itself an indication that perhaps he's got one half an eye on his future career on the talk show circuit.
Right.
As I don't know if the American listeners will know that, you know, he has actually gone public and said that he won't be standing again for election. He would be allowed to, and the idea is he's going to step aside for Gordon Brown, the number two, to step through. Anyway,
right.
On that program, in a discussion about, first of all, religion. Tony Blair brought religion up. Actually, it was in a discussion about how he first became political, and he actually said, initially talking about his own life, that he had come to politics and he'd come to religion at about the same time when he was at university. So that, and it was pretty much unbidden by Michael Parkinson, and not especially controversial either. I mean, everyone in Britain knows that he's a Christian. Later on, the controversial element was later on when he was discussing the war in Iraq, and there's been lots of kind of misquotations of what he said, but I think I've got a fairly accurate report which says that when he was asked how he made the decision and whether he thought it was the right decision, he made reference to the fact that he believed in God, and therefore, at times like that, when you're making that kind of decision, he wasn't sure if it was the right decision, but he felt he would be judged as to whether it was right by God. Now, as many people have commented, on the one hand, he did not say, God made me do it,
right,
or, you know, it was a crusade, or it was a religious war. On the other hand, as other people have said, it was pretty crazy to tie together in the public's mind the issue of religious belief, God judging things, and the Iraq war. Obviously, just like in America, there's lots of controversy about the Iraq war here, and the electorate would like to think that it would be them who would judge whether it was a good decision or not.
Exactly.
Rather than, you know, some higher power. So while what Tony Blair said, I mean, speaking as a humanist and as a, you know, someone who holds no brief, I don't think it was quite as, I mean, certainly, in relation to America, it was completely non-controversial. I mean, George Bush and other American politicians say much, much more overt things about the way the role religion plays in their decision-making life. And as various people have said, it was quite diffidently done by the Prime Minister, although it was clear that he'd put it on the agenda himself, which has actually been pretty consistent with the fact that, you know, religion as a political kind of tool doesn't have a great deal of purchase in the UK, but Tony Blair, throughout his career, has always, you know, managed to get the point across that he was a religious person.
Right. So, what was the public reaction to this comment? You say there was.
Well, it's hard to say. What, you know, with many of these things, you never really know what the public reaction is. What you know is what's the reaction of the media. So immediately, the media goes into a kind of hyperdrive, saying, you know, did Tony Blair take instructions from God? you know. God should judge it. Is that the right way? You know, what do people think about this? So there was quite a lot of kind of, a little bit of a kind of media fuss about it. Having said that, and once again, speaking as someone for whom, you know, I hold no brief about this, I think it was a bit of a storm in a teacup. But what it did allow people to kind of vent some of their frustration or some of their anxiety about the possibility. I mean, there is a long-running underlying story, for example, about whether, in fact, Tony Blair and George Bush prayed together when they were making the decision to invade Iraq. I mean, it's widely reported and known here that when Tony Blair went out to visit George Bush in whenever it was, November 2003 or something, the decision was made to invade Iraq considerably before anyone else was told about it. And the question was this done, you know, with divine intervention? Was there praying going on? And I suppose beyond that, there's a question of what was the influence of the religious right on that decision, and a decision which, you know, was cast at certain point as a crusade, as a religious conflict. And those of us who are not, are not religious, we are against the war for reasons of, you know, political reasons, would be extremely concerned by the idea that, in fact, this was a war which had religious motivation.
So it sounds like the British media take the inclusion of religion or a religious dimension to that decision to be a bad thing.
Well, once again, I think we must distinguish between what the media think, which is I'm not sure the media think anything. What they try and do is stir up trouble. And, I mean, speaking as a member of the media myself, I mean, the media are looking for weak points on newspapers.
When they see something that's a weak point, it still tells you something about the general public, because they're seeing that issue as being something that would be controversial, whereas in other countries it wouldn't stir up any trouble at all to say that the leader of the country was religious.
I think that's a fair point, although I think that actually it didn't stir up the trouble that you might imagine, and I think there are good reasons for it. And this was something which... an American academic who came to the UK last week and was at a conference that we organised called the State of Faith. It was a conference about the relationship between religion and politics. We did it together with the Institute of Public Policy Research in central London. We had a panel about the Enlightenment and whether the Enlightenment was over or needed to be renewed, and how did it kind of set the tone for politics. And in one aspect of the Enlightenment, of course, was the rejection of religion. And also Charles Clarke, who is the Home Secretary, I don't know how you would put that in an American idiom, but he's in charge of, you know, the police and security.
The Minister for the Interior, perhaps.
Minister for the Interior, or Homeland Security as well, that would be included. Anyway, he got up and made a statement from the government, and the basic statement was, we think faith is a good thing. Faith binds communities together, faith provides basics and basic values, faith can be important in education. This was partly as a way to support their policy vis-a-vis faith schools, which is something that they're keen to sort of back. Now, but he said that when he said this, he also said, I myself am not a believer. I don't believe in God, but I don't mind if people do. I recognise there are multiple faiths here, and there are people of no faith. And the humanist obviously nodded, smiled at that. And we think, you know, having faith is not a bad thing for the public sphere. Now, whether or not you accept that, what was striking for Stephen Eric Bronner, who was sitting right next to me, who's this professor from Rutgers, he just said, you could never say that. An American politician could never say that.
That's
in America.
True. Yeah.
No matter whether they believe in God or not, they have to... Well, I mean, this led me to my assumption that some of them must not believe in God, but are too afraid to say it. Now, that is virtually the opposite in England. It's still the case. Tony Blair still stands out as a bit of a weirdo for English people, because he goes on about religion and has got this slightly kind of trendy vicar type feel, which
and
is really somewhere between, I don't know, I'd say a third and maybe even a half of elected politicians, this is in the House of Commons and also in the Lords, are of no faith.
Which is a very strong contrast to the US, because as you say, in the UK it may be a disadvantage to say you're religious. In the US, if you want to be elected, you have to say you're religious. So whenever I'm asked if there's any atheists in American politics, I say that there probably are, but they're only dishonest atheists, because they could only get elected by saying they're actually religious.
And what a ridiculous thing that is. And it really, really marked a profound difference. I mean, the other thing to remember, and this is the real irony of the situation, is America, this religious country, has got formal separation of church and state. Britain, this basically secular country, I mean, less than 10% of the population go to church, or mosque or whatever, but we're talking mainly about Christianity here, does still have an established religion.
Right.
The Church of England is established. And on the panel also was this guy called Robert Hazel talking, who's done research into that. And he did remind us that, you know, there is still a linkage between the state and the church. The senior bishops serve in the House of Lords, i.e. we have bishops who have some degree of political power. The Prime Minister still gets involved in appointing bishops. And they have some degree of, you know, even though it's very, very latent, it's a bit like the role of the Queen, and it's kind of hemmed in, we still have this established religion. Having said that, the church attendance has plummeted to such a degree. I mean, I found this very funny thing, which is on the Church of England website itself, and it's a kind of an assessment of what's gone on. And in the 1950s, 50% of Britons apparently went to church, or 40 to 50%. It's now 10%. That other 30 or 40% people have just disappeared as believers, and one argument is that's because religion has been taken over by extreme views, so it's no longer possible to be a kind of wishy-washy, you know, moral Christian, but basically a secular person. Most people have just moved over to secularism. Now, the Church of England are in a panic about this, but what they're saying are things like, just because the trend is down doesn't mean it's going to disappear completely, because, you know, theatre attendances were down a while ago, and so were football matches, but they've come up again, so maybe, you know, I mean, it's really a level of Well, it's really, really quite sad almost for those people.
The quality of the sock has improved, but I don't think the quality of the religion is improving in the UK.
That would be my argument.
We're going to have to wrap this up, Casper, but yeah. Thanks for shedding so much light on the differences between the US and UK, and let's hope that the US can emulate the UK in making religion far less important in politics.
You've certainly got your work cut out, I'd say.
We have. Thank you very much.
Good to talk to you, Matt.
That was Casper Melville, editor of New Humanist, a magazine published in the United Kingdom. Matt Sherry, executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies, spoke with Casper on Monday. Although during that last segment you might have forgotten and thought you were listening to the BBC, you're actually listening to Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. To learn more about New Humanist and to read it online, visit newhumanist.org.uk. I give out a lot of URLs during these shows, and if you're driving or wherever you're listening, if you can't write this down, don't worry about it. You can always visit our H&N podcast blog page or our show notes at ihs.libsyn.com. You got to remember that, but I guess if you forget, you can do a Google search for Humanist Network News, and you should probably find us that way. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. We will return next month. In the meantime, be sure to visit the Humanist Network News e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. Humanist Network News, the podcast, and e-zine are made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting humanism, a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion. The Institute advances human rights, secular ethics, and the separation of religion and government through advocacy, innovation, and collaboration. Check out the Institute's brand new website at humaniststudies.org. Don't forget to call the H&N listener comment line, 206-339-4168. And don't forget to review our show on iTunes. Special thanks again to Holly Neer for allowing the Institute to use her song as our theme music. And thank you for listening.
Of what you do.